is from playing locally and from showing up for the Davenport Cocksuckers workouts. They could have done it because they were a wealthy, long-established Iowa family, and Gene Katsanis was a nobody who grew up in an orphan home, a Christian orphan home that was probably hell on earth. I think maybe Billy got ragging on the kid once too often and once too hard. Or it could have been the dad or the mom. Maybe it was over the way he milked the cows. Or maybe he didn't shovel the shit just right that one time. But I'll bet the bottom line was baseball and plain old jealousy. The green-eyed monster. For all I know, the cornholer's manager told Blakely he might be sent down to Single-A in Clearwater. And getting sent down a rung when you're only 20, when you're supposed to be going up the ladder, is a damn good sign that your career in organized baseball is going to be a short one. But however it was, and whoever, it was a bad mistake. The kid could be sweet when he was treated right. We all knew that. But he wasn't right in the head. And he could be dangerous. I knew that even before the cops showed up because of what happened in the very first game of the season. Billy Anderson. The county sheriff found all three Blakeleys in the barn, Lombardozzi said. Katsani slashed their throats. Sheriff said it looked like a razor blade. I just gaped at him. What must have happened is this, Joe said in a heavy voice. Kerwin McCaslin called around for a backup catcher when our guys got hurt down in Florida, and the manager of the Cornhuskers said he had a boy who might fill the bill for 3 or 4 weeks, assuming we didn't need him to hit for average, because he said this kid wouldn't do that. But he did, I says. Because he wasn't Blakely, Lombardozzi says. By then Blakely and his parents must already have been dead a couple of days, at least. The Katsanis kid was keeping house, all by himself. And not all his screws were loose. He was smart enough to answer the phone when it rang. He took the call from the manager and said, sure, Billy'd be glad to go to New Jersey. And before he left, as Billy, he called around to the neighbors in the feed store downtown, told them the Blakeleys had been called away on a family emergency, and he was taking care of things. Pretty smart for a loony, wouldn't you say? He's not a loony, I told him. Well, he cut the throats of the people who took him in and gave him a job. And he killed all the cows so the neighbors wouldn't hear them bawling to be milked at night. But have it your way. I know the DA's gonna agree with you, because he wants to see Katsanis get the rope. That's how they do it in Iowa, you know. I turned to Joe. How could a thing like this happen? Because he was good, Joe said, and because he wanted to play ball. The kid had Billy Blakely's ID. And this was back in the days when picture IDs were unheard of. The two kids matched up pretty well. Blue eyes, dark hair, 6 feet tall. But mostly, yeah, it happened because the kid was good and wanted to play ball. Good enough to get almost a month in the pros, Lombardozzi said, and over our heads a cheer went up. Billy Blockade had just gotten his last big league hit, a homer. Then day before yesterday, the LP gas man went out to the Blakely farm. Other folks had been there before, but they read the note Katsanis left on the door and went away. Not the gas man. He filled the tanks behind the barn, and the barn was where the bodies were, cows and Blakely's both. The weather had finally turned warm, and he smelled him, which is pretty much the way our story ends. Now, your manager here wants him arrested with as little fuss as possible and with as little danger to the other players on your team as possible. That's fine with me. So your job is to hold the rest of the guys in the dugout, Jersey Joe says. Send Blakely, Katsanis, down here on his own. He'll be gone when the rest of the guys get to the locker room. Then we'll try to sort this clusterfuck out. What the hell do I tell them? Team meeting. Free ice cream. I don't care. You just hold them for 5 minutes. I says to Lombardazzi, no one tipped? No one? You mean no one heard the radio broadcasts and tried calling Pop Blakely to say how great it was that his kid was tearing up the bigs? I imagine one or two might have tried, Lombardazzi said. Folks from Iowa do come to the big city from time to time, I'm told, and I imagine a few people visiting New York listened to the Titans or read about them in the paper. I prefer the Yankees, one of the blue suits chimes in. If I want your opinion, I'll rattle the bars in your cage, Lombardazzi said. Until then, shut up and die right. I looked at Joe, feeling sick, getting a bad call and getting run off the field during my first managerial stint now seemed like the very least of my problems. Get him in here alone, Joe said. I don't care how. The guy shouldn't have to see this. He thought it over and added, and the kid shouldn't have to see them seeing it, no matter what he did. If it matters, and I know it don't, we lost that game 2-1. All three runs were solo shots. Manny Minoso hit the game winner off a Gansey in the top of the ninth. The kid made the final out. He whiffed in his first at bat as a Titan. He whiffed in his last one. Baseball is also a game of balance. But none of our guys cared about the game. When I got up there, they were gathered around the dude who was sitting on the bench and telling them he was fine, goddammit, just a little dizzy. But he didn't look fine, and our old excuse for a doc looked pretty grave. He wanted Danny down at Newark General for x-rays. Fuck that, Dew says. I just need a couple of minutes. I'm all right, I tell you. Jesus, Bones, cut me a break. Blakely, I said, go on down to the locker room. Mr. DiPunno wants to see you. Coach DiPunno wants to see me? In the locker room? Why? Something about the Rookie of the Month award, I said. It just popped into my head from nowhere. There was no such thing back then, but the kid didn't know that. The kid looks at Danny Dew, and the Dew flaps his hand at him. Go on, get out of here, kid. You played a good game. Not your fault. You're still lucky, and fuck anyone who says different. Then he says, all of you get out of here. Give me some breathing room. Hold off on that, I says. Joe wants to see him alone. Give him a little one-to-one congratulations, I guess. Kid, don't wait around. Just scat was how I meant to finish. But I didn't have to. Blakely or Katsanis? He was already gone. And you know what happened after that. If the kid had gone straight down the hall to the umpire's room, he would have gotten collared because the locker room was on the way. Instead, he cut through our box room, where luggage was stored, and where we also had a couple of massage tables and a whirlpool bath. We'll never know for sure why he did that, but I think the kid knew something was wrong. Crazy or not, he must have known the roof was going to fall in on him eventually. In any case, he came out on the far side of the locker room, walked down to the ump's room, and knocked on the door. By then, the rig he probably learned how to make in the Ottershaw Christian home was back on his second finger. One of the older boys probably showed him how, that's what I think. Kid, if you want to stop getting beaten up all the time, make yourself one of these. He never put it back in his locker after all, you see. Just tucked it into his pocket. And he didn't bother with the Band-Aid after the game, which tells me he knew he didn't have anything to hide anymore. He raps on the umpire's door and says, urgent telegram for Mr. High Winders. Crazy but not stupid, you see. I don't know what would have happened if one of the other umps on the crew had opened up. But it was Winders himself, and I'm betting his life was over even before he realized it wasn't a Western Union delivery boy standing there. It was a razor blade, see? Or a piece of one, anyway. When it wasn't needed, it stayed inside a little tin band, like a kid's pretend finger ring. Only, when he balled his right fist and pushed on the band with the ball of his thumb, that little sliver of a blade popped up on a spring. Wenders opened the door, and Katsanis swept it across his neck and cut his throat with it. When I saw the puddle of blood after he was taken away in handcuffs, oh my God, such a pool of it there was. All I could think of was those 40,000 people screaming, "Kill the ump!" the same way they'd been screaming, "Blockade!" No one really means it, but the kid didn't know that either. Especially not after the Dew poured a lot of poison in his ears about how Wenders was out to get both of them. When the cops ran out of the locker room, Billy Blockade was just standing there with blood all down the front of his white home uniform and Wenders laying at his feet. Nor did he try to fight or slash when the blue suits grabbed him. No, he just stood there whispering to himself, "I got him, Dew. I got him, Billy. He won't make no more bad calls now. I got him for all of us." That's where the story ends, Mr. King. The part of it I know, at least. As far as the Titans go, you could look it up, as old Casey used to say. All those games canceled out, and all the double headers we played to make them up, how we ended up with old Hubie Ratner behind the plate after all, and how he batted 185, well below what they now call the Mendoza line, how Danny Dewson was diagnosed with something called an intracranial bleed and had to sit out the rest of the season, how he tried to come back in 1958. That was sad. 5 outings. In 3 of them, he couldn't get the ball over the plate. And the other 2, do you remember the last Red Sox-Yankees playoff game in 2004, how Kevin Brown started for the Yankees? And the Sox scored 6 goddamn runs off him in the first 2 innings? That's how Danny Dew pitched in 58, when he actually managed to get the ball over the dish. He had nothing. And still, after all that, we managed to finish ahead of the Senators and the Athletics. Only Jersey Joe DiPunno had a heart attack during the World Series that year. Might have been the same day the Russians put the Sputnik up. They took him out of County Stadium on a stretcher. He lived another 5 years, but he was a shadow of his former self, and of course he never managed again. He said the kid sucked luck, and he was more right than he knew, Mr. King. That kid was a black hole for luck. For himself as well. I'm sure you know how his story ended. How he was taken to Essex County Jail and held there for extradition. How he swallowed a bar of soap and choked to death on it. I can't think of a worse way to go. That was a nightmare season, no doubt. And still, telling you about it brought back some good memories. Mostly, I think of how old Swampy would flush orange when all those fans raised their signs. "Road closed by order of Blockade Billy." Yep, I bet the fellow who thought those up made a goddamn mint. But you know, the people who bought them got fair value. When they stood up with them held over their heads, they were part of something bigger than themselves. That can be a bad thing. Just think of all the people who turned out to see Hitler at his rallies. But this was a good thing. Baseball is a good thing. Always was. Always will be. Blockade. 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 Still gives me a chill to think of it. Still echoes in my head. That kid was the real thing, crazy or not. Luck sucker or not. Mr. King, I think I'm all talked out. Do you have enough? Good. I'm glad. You come back anytime you want. But not on Wednesday afternoon. That's when they have their goddamn virtual bowling and you can't hear yourself think. Come on Saturday, why don't you? There's a bunch of us always watches the game of the week. We're allowed a couple of beers, and we root like mad bastards. It ain't like the old days, but it ain't bad.
For Flip Thompson, friend and high school catcher, Some stand in for me in one of the early novels. I think it was Ben Mears in Salem's Lot, says it's a bad idea to talk about a story you're planning to write. It's like pissing it out on the ground, is how he puts it. Sometimes, though, especially if I'm feeling enthusiastic, I find it hard to take my own advice. That was the case with Mr. Yummy. When I sketched out the rough idea to a friend, he listened carefully and then shook his head. I don't think you've got anything new to say about AIDS, Steve. He paused and added, especially as a straight man. No, and no, and especially no. I hate the assumption that you can't write about something because you haven't experienced it, and not just because it assumes a limit on the human imagination, which is basically limitless. It also suggests that some leaps of identification are impossible. I refuse to accept that because it leads to the conclusion that real change is beyond us, and so is empathy. The idea is false on the evidence. Like shit, change happens. If the British and Irish can make peace, you gotta believe there's a chance that someday the Jews and Palestinians will work things out. Change only occurs as a result of hard work. I think we'd all agree on that, but hard work isn't enough. It also requires a strenuous leap of the imagination. What is it really like to be in the other guy or gal's shoes? And hey, I never wanted to write a story about AIDS or being gay anyhow. Those things were only the framing device. What I wanted to write about was the brute power of the human sex drive. That power, it seems to me, holds sway over those of every orientation, especially when young. At some point, on the right or wrong night, in a good place or a bad one, desire rises up and will not be denied. Caution is swept away. Cogent thought ceases. Risk no longer matters. That's what I wanted to write about.
Mr. Yummy, read by Peter Friedman.
One. Dave Calhoun was helping Olga Lyukov construct the Eiffel Tower. They had been at it for 6 mornings now, 6 early mornings, in the common room of the Lakeview Assisted Living Center. They were hardly alone in there. Old people rise early. The giant flat screen on the far side started blatting the usual rabble-rousing junk from Fox News at 5:30, and a number of residents were watching it with their mouths agape.
Oh, Olga said. Here's one I've been looking for.
She tapped a piece of girder into place halfway down Gustav Eiffel's masterpiece, created, according to the back of the box, from junk metal. Dave heard the tap of a cane approaching from behind him and greeted the newcomer without turning his head.
Good morning, Ollie. You're up early.
As a young man, Dave wouldn't have believed you could ID someone simply by the sound of his cane. But as a young man, he had never dreamed he would finish his time on Earth in a place where so many people used them.
Good morning right back at you, Ollie Franklin said. And to you, Olga.
She looked up briefly, then back down at the puzzle. 1,000 pieces, according to the box, and most now where they belonged.
These girders are a bugger. I see them floating in front of me every time I close my eyes. I believe I'll go for a smoke and wake up my lungs.
Smoking was supposedly verboten in Lakeview, but Olga and a few other diehards were allowed to slip through the kitchen to the loading dock, where there was a butt can. She rose, tottered, cursed in either Russian or Polish, caught her balance, and shuffled away. Then she stopped and looked back at Dave, eyebrows drawn together.
Leave some for me, bub. Do you promise?
He raised his hand, palm out.
So help me God.
Satisfied, she shuffled on, digging in the pocket of her shapeless day dress for her butts and her bick. Ollie raised his own eyebrows.
Since when are you, Bob?
He was her husband. You remember, came here with her, died 2 years ago.
All right. And now she's losing it. That's too bad.
Dave shrugged. She'll be 90 in the fall if she makes it. She's entitled to a few slip cogs, and look at this.
He gestured at the puzzle which filled an entire card table.
She did most of it herself. I'm just her assistant.
Ollie, who had been a graphic designer in what he called his real life, looked at the nearly completed puzzle gloomily.
La Tour Eiffel. Do you know there was an artist protest when it was under construction?
No, but I'm not surprised. The French.
The novelist Léon Bois called it a truly tragic street lamp.
Calhoun looked at the puzzle, saw what Blois had meant, and laughed. It did look like a street lamp, sort of.
Some other artist or writer, I can't remember who, claimed that the best view of Paris was from the Eiffel Tower because it was the only view of Paris without the Eiffel Tower in it.
Ollie bent closer, one hand gripping his cane, the other pressed against the small of his back, as if to hold it together. His eyes moved from the puzzle to the scatter of remaining pieces, perhaps 100 in all, then back to the puzzle.
Houston, you may have a problem here.
Dave had already begun to suspect this.
If you're right, it's going to ruin Olga's day.
Oh, she should have expected it. How many times do you think this version of the Eiffel has been assembled and then taken apart again? Old people are as careless as teenagers.
He straightened up.
Would you walk outside in the garden with me? I have something to give you. Also, something to tell you.
Dave studied Ollie.
You okay?
The other chose not to answer this.
Come outside. It's a beautiful morning, warming up nicely.
Ollie led the way toward the patio, his cane tapping out that familiar 1-2-3 rhythm, tossing a good morning wave to someone as he passed the coffee-drinking coterie of TV watchers. Dave followed willingly enough, but slightly mystified. 2. Lakeview was built in a U-shape, with the common room between two extending arms that comprised the assisted living suites, each suite consisting of a sitting room, a bedroom, and the sort of bathroom that came equipped with handrails and a shower chair. These suites were not cheap. Although many of the residents were no longer strictly continent, Dave had begun suffering his own nighttime accidents not long after turning 83, and now kept boxes of PM pull-ups on a high shelf in his closet. It was not the sort of place that smelled of piss and Lysol. The rooms also came with satellite TV. There was a snack buffet in each wing, and twice a month there were wine-tasting parties. All things considered, Dave thought, it was a pretty good place to run out the string. The garden between the residence wings was lush, almost orgasmic, with early summer. Paths wandered, and a central fountain splashed. The flowers rioted, but in a genteel, well-barbered way. Here and there were house telephones, where a walker suddenly afflicted with shortness of breath or spreading numbness in the legs could call for assistance. There would be plenty of walkers later on, when those not yet risen or when those in the common room got their fill of Fox News, came out to enjoy the day before it heated up. But for the time being, Dave and Ollie had it to themselves. Once they were through the double doors and down the steps from the wide flagstoned patio, both of them descending with care, Ollie stopped and began fumbling in the pocket of the baggy houndstooth check sport coat he was wearing. He brought out a silver pocket watch on a heavy silver chain. He held it out to Dave.
I want you to have this. It was my great-grandfather's. Judging by the engraving inside the cover, he either bought it or had it given to him in 1890.
Dave gazed at the watch, swinging on his chain from Ollie Franklin's slightly palsied hand like a hypnotist's amulet, with amusement and horror.
I can't take that.
Patiently, as if instructing a child, Ollie said,
You can if I give it to you, and I've seen you admire it many and many a time.
It's a family heirloom.
Yes, indeed, and my brother will take it if it's in my effects when I die, which I'm going to do, and soon, perhaps tonight, certainly in the next few days.
Dave didn't know what to say. Still in that same patient tone, Ollie said,
My brother Tom isn't worth the powder it would take to blow him to Des Moines. I have never said as much to him, it would be cruel, but I've said so many times to you, haven't I?
Well, yeah.
I have supported him through 3 failed businesses and 2 failed marriages. I believe I told you that many times as well, haven't I?
Yes, but...
I did well, and I invested well,
Ollie said, beginning to walk and tapping his cane at his own personal code. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, 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 tap.
I am one of the infamous 1% so reviled by the liberal young. Not by a lot, mind you, but by enough to have lived comfortably here for the last 3 years while continuing to serve as my younger brother's safety net. I no longer have to perform that service for his daughter, thank God. Martha actually seems to be earning a living for herself, which is a relief. I've made a will, all proper and correct, and in it I've done the proper thing, the family thing. Since I have no wife or children myself, that means leaving everything to Tom. Except this. This is for you. You've been a good friend to me, so please, take it.
Dave considered, decided he could give it back when his friend's death premonition passed, and took the watch. He clicked it open and admired the crystal face. 6:22, right on time as far as he could tell. The second hand moved briskly in its own little circle, just above the scrolled 6.
"Cleaned several times, but repaired only once,"
Molly said, resuming his slow ambulation.
"In 1923, according to Grampy, after my father dropped it down the well on the old farm in Hemingford home. Can you imagine that? Over 120 years old and only repaired once. How many human beings on earth can claim that? A dozen? Maybe only 6? You have 2 sons and a daughter, am I right?"
"You are," Dave said. His friend had grown increasingly frail over the last year, and his hair was nothing but a few baby-fine wisps on his liver-spotted skull, but his mind was ticking along a little better than Olga's. "Or my own," he admitted to himself.
"The watch isn't in my will, but it should go in yours. I'm sure you love all your children equally. You're that kind of guy.
But liking is different, isn't it? Leave it to the one you like the best." That would be Peter, Dave thought, and smiled. Either returning the smile or catching the thought behind it, Ollie's lips parted over his remaining teeth, and he nodded.
"Let's sit down. I'm bushed. It doesn't take much these days."
They sat on one of the benches, and Dave tried to hand the watch back. Ollie pushed his hands out in an exaggerated repelling gesture that was comical enough to make Dave laugh, although he recognized this as a serious matter. Certainly more serious than a few missing pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. The smell of the flowers was strong, heavenly. When Dave Calhoun thought of death, not so far off now, the prospect he regretted most was the loss of the sensory world and all its ordinary luxuries. The sight of a woman's cleavage in a boat-neck top. The sound of Cozy Cole going bullshit on the drums in Topsy Part 2. The taste of lemon pie with a cloud of meringue on top. The smell of flowers he could not name, although his wife would have known them all.
"Ollie, you may be going to die this week. God knows everyone in this place has one foot in the grave and the other on a banana peel, but there's no way you can know for sure. I don't know if you had a dream or a black cat crossed your path or something else, but premonitions are bullshit."
"I didn't just have a premonition," Ollie said. "I saw one. I saw Mr. Yummy. I've seen him several times in the last 2 weeks. Always closer. Pretty soon I'll have a room visit, and that'll be that. I don't mind. In fact, I'm looking forward to it. Life's a great thing, but if you live long enough, it wears out before it runs out."
"Mr. Yummy?" Calhoun said. "Who the hell is Mr. Yummy?"
"It's not really him," Ollie said, as if he hadn't heard. "I know that. It's a representation of him. A summation of a time and place, if you like. Although there was a real Mr. Yummy once. That's what my friends and I called him that night in High Pockets. I never knew his real name."
"I'm not following."
"Listen, you know I'm gay, right?"
Dave smiled. "Well, I think your dating days were over before I met you, but I had a pretty good idea, yeah?"
"Was it the ascot?"
"It's the way you walk," Dave thought, "even with a cane. The way you run your fingers through what remains of your hair and then glance in the mirror. The way you roll your eyes at the women on that Real Housewives show. Even the still-life drawings in your room, which form a kind of timeline of your decline. Once you must have been so good, but now your hands shake."
"You're right.
It wears out before it runs out."
"Among other things," Dave said.
"Have you ever heard someone say they were too old for one of America's military adventures, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan?
Sure, although what they usually say is they were too young.
AIDS was a war. Ollie was looking down at his gnarled hands, from which the talent was departing. And I wasn't too old for all of it, because no one is, when the war's on one's native soil, wouldn't you say?
I guess that's true enough.
I was born in 1930. When AIDS was first observed and clinically described in the United States, I was 52. I was living in New York and working freelance for several advertising firms. My friends and I still used to go around to the clubs in the village once in a while, not the Stonewall, a hellhole run by the mafia, but some of the others. One night I was standing outside Peter Pepper's on Christopher Street, sharing a J with a friend, and a bunch of young men went in. Good-looking guys in tight bell-bottom pants and the shirts they all seemed to wear back then, the kind with the wide shoulders and narrow waists, suede boots with stacked heels. Yummy boys, Dave ventured. I guess, but not the yummy boy. And my best friend, his name was Noah Fremont, died just last year. I went to the funeral. He turned to me and he said, "They don't even see us anymore, do they?" I agreed. They saw you if you had enough money, but we were too dignified for that, you might say. Paying for it was demeaning, although some of us did, from time to time. Yet, in the late 50s, when I first came to New York, he shrugged and looked off into the distance.
When you first came to New York, Dave prompted. I'm thinking about how to say this. In the late 50s, when women were still sighing over Rock Hudson and Liberace, when homosexuality was the love that dared not speak its name instead of the one that never shuts up, my sex drive was at its absolute peak. In that way, there are others, I'm sure, many others, gay men and straight men are the same. I read somewhere that when they are in the presence of an attractive other, men think about sex every 20 seconds or so. But when a man's in his teens and 20s, he thinks about sex constantly, whether he's in the presence of an attractive other or not. You get hard when the wind blows, Dave said. He was thinking of his first job as a pump jockey, and of a pretty redhead he'd happened to see sliding out of the passenger seat of her boyfriend's truck. Her skirt had rucked up, revealing her plain white cotton panties for a single second, two at most. Yet he had played that moment over and over in his mind while masturbating. And although he had only been 16 at the time, the memory was still fresh and clear. He doubted if that would have been the case if he'd been 50. By then, he'd seen plenty of women's underwear.
Some of the conservative columnists called AIDS the gay plague, and with ill-concealed satisfaction. It was a plague, but by 1986 or so, the gay community had a pretty good fix on it. We understood the two most basic preventive measures, no unprotected sex and no sharing of needles. But young men think they're immortal, and as my grandma used to say when she was in her cups, a stiff dick has no conscience. It's especially true when the owner of that dick is drunk, high, and in the throes of sexual attraction. Ollie sighed, shrugged. Chances were taken. Mistakes were made. Even after the transmission vectors were well understood, tens of thousands of gay men died. People are only beginning to grasp the magnitude of that tragedy, now that most folks understand gays don't choose their sexual orientation. Great poets, great musicians, great mathematicians and scientists, God knows how many died before their talents could flower. They died in gutters, in cold water flats, in hospitals, in the indigent wards, all because they took a risk on a night when the music was loud, the wine was flowing, and the poppers were popping. By choice, there's still plenty who say so, but that's nonsense. The drive is too strong, too primal. If I'd been born 20 years later, I might have been one of the casualties. My friend Noah as well. But he died of a heart attack in his bed. And I'll die of whatever. Because by 50, there are fewer sexual temptations to resist, and even when the temptation is strong, the brain is sometimes able to overrule the cock, at least long enough to grab a condom. I'm not saying that plenty of men my age didn't die of AIDS. They did. No fool like an old fool, right? Some were my friends, but they were fewer than the younger fellas who jammed the clubs every night. My own clique, Noah, Henry Reed, John Rubin,
Frank Diamond, sometimes went out just to watch those young guys do their mating dances. We didn't drool, but we watched. We weren't so different from the middle-aged hetero golfing buddies who go to Hooters once a week just to watch the waitresses bend over. That sort of behavior may be slightly pitiful, but it's not unnatural. Or do you disagree? Dave shook his head. One night, four or five of us dropped by a dance club called High Pockets. I think we had just about decided to call it a night when this kid walked in on his own. Looked a little like David Bowie. He was tall, wearing tight white bike shorts and a blue tee with cut-off sleeves. Long blonde hair, combed up in a high pompadour that was funny and sexy at the same time. High color, natural, not rouge, in his cheeks, along with a spangle of silvery stuff. A cupid's bow of a mouth. Every eye in the place turned to look at him. Noah grabbed my arm and said, "That's him. That's Mr. Yummy. I'd give $1,000 to take him home." I laughed and said, $1,000 wouldn't buy him. At that age and with those looks, all he wanted was to be admired and desired. Also to have great sex as often as possible. And when you're 22, that's often. Pretty soon, he was part of a group of good-looking guys, although none as good-looking as he was. All of them laughing and drinking and dancing whatever dance was in back then. None of them sparing a glance for the quartet of middle-aged men sitting at a table far back from the dance floor and drinking wine. Middle-aged men still 5 or 10 years from quitting their efforts to look younger than their age. Why would he look at us with all those lovely young men vying for his attention? And Frank Diamond said he'll be dead in a year. See how pretty he is then. Only he didn't just say it, he spit it out, like that was some kind of weird, I don't know, consolation prize. Ollie, who had survived the age of the deep closet to live in one where gay marriage was legal in most states, once more shrugged his thin shoulders, as if to say it was all water under the bridge. So that was our Mr. Yummy, a summation of all that was beautiful and desirable and out of reach. I never saw him again. Until 2 weeks ago. Not at High Pockets, not at Peter Pepper's or the Tall Glass, not at any of the other clubs I went to, although I went to those places less and less frequently as the so-called Reagan era wore on. By the late 80s, going to the gay clubs was too weird, like attending the masquerade ball in Poe's story about the Red Death. You know, come on, everybody, kick out the jams, have another glass of champagne, and ignore all those people dropping like flies. There was no fun in that unless you were 22 and still under the impression that you were bulletproof. It must have been hard. Ollie raised the hand not wedded to his cane and waggled it in a come-see-come-saw gesture. Was and wasn't. It was what the recovering alkies call life on life's terms. Dave considered letting it go at that and decided he couldn't. The gift of the watch was too dismaying. "Listen to your Uncle Dave, Ollie. Words of one syllable. You did not see that kid. You might have seen someone who looked a little like him, but if your Mr. Yummy was 22 back then, he'd be in his 50s himself by now. If he avoided AIDS, that is. It was just a trick your brain played on you."
"My elderly brain," Ollie said, smiling, "my going-on-senile brain."
"I never said senile. You're not that, but your brain is elderly."
"Undoubtedly. But it was him. It was. The first time I saw him, he was on Maryland Avenue at the foot of the main drive. A few days later, he was lounging on the porch steps below the main entrance, smoking a clove cigarette. 2 days ago, he was sitting on a bench outside the admission office, still wearing that blue sleeveless tee and those blinding white shorts. He should have stopped traffic, but nobody saw him except for me, that is."
I refused to humor him, Dave thought. "He deserves better." "You're hallucinating, pal." Ollie was unfazed.
"Just now he was in the common room watching TV with the rest of the early birds. I waved to him and he waved back."
A grin, startlingly youthful, broke on Ollie's face.
"He also tipped me a wink."
"White bike shorts, sleeveless tee, 22 and good-looking. I may be straight, but I think I would have noticed that."
"He's here for me. So I'm the only one who can see him. QED.
He hoisted himself to his feet.
"Shall we go back? I'm ready for coffee."
They walked toward the patio,
where they would climb the steps as carefully as they had descended them. Once they had lived in the Reagan era, now they lived in the era of glass hips. When they reached the flagstones outside the common room, they both paused for breath. When Dave had his, he said, "So what have we learned today, class? That death personified isn't a skeleton riding on a pale horse with a scythe over his shoulder, but a hot dance hall kid with glitter on his cheeks."
"I imagine different people see different avatars," Ollie said mildly. "According to what I've read, the majority see their mothers once they reach death's door."
"Ollie, the majority sees no one, and you're not in mort—"
"My mother, however, died shortly after I was born, so I wouldn't even recognize her."
He started for the double doors, but Dave took his arm. "I'll keep the watch until the Halloween party, how's that? 4 months. And I'll wind it religiously. But if you're still around then, you take it back. Deal?" Ollie beamed.
"Absolutely. Let's go see how Olga's doing with Laturi Fell, shall we?"
Olga was back at the card table, staring down at the puzzle. It was not a happy stare.
"I left you the last three pieces, Dave."
Unhappy or not, she was at least clear on who he was again.
"But that will still leave 4 holes. After a week's work, this is very disappointing."
"Shit happens, Olga," Dave said, sitting down. He tapped the remaining pieces into place with a satisfaction that went all the way back to rainy days at summer camp, where, he now realized, the common room had been quite a bit like this. Life was a short shelf that came with bookends.
"Yes, it does," she said, contemplating the missing 4 pieces. "It certainly does. But so much shit, Bob, so much."
"Olga, I'm Dave." She turned her frown on him.
"That's what I said."
No sense arguing, and no sense trying to convince her that 996 out of 1,000 was a fine score. She's 10 years from 100 and still thinks she deserves perfection, Dave thought. Some people have remarkably sturdy illusions. He looked up and saw Ollie emerging from the closet-sized craft center adjacent to the common room. He was holding a sheet of tissue paper and a pen. He made his way to the table and floated the tissue onto the puzzle.
"Here, here, what are you doing?" Olga asked. "Show some patience for once in your life, dear, you see."
She stuck out her lower lip like a pouty child.
"No, I'm going to smoke. If you want to take that damn thing apart, be my guest. Put it back in the box or knock it on the floor. Your choice is no good the way it is."
She stalked off with as much hauteur as her arthritis would allow. Ollie dropped into her seat with a sigh of relief.
"That's much better. Bending's a bitch these days."
He traced 2 of the missing pieces, which happened to be close together, then moved the paper to trace the other 2. Dave watched with interest.
"Will that work?"
"Oh, yeah," Ollie said. "There are some cardboard FedEx boxes in the mailroom. I'll filch one of them. Do some cutting and a little drawing. Just don't let Olga have a tantrum and disassemble the damn thing before I get back."
"If you want photos, you know, for matching purposes, I'll get my iPhone."
"Don't need it."
Ollie tapped his forehead gravely.
"Got my camera up here. It's an old brownie box instead of a smartphone, but even these days it works pretty well."
3. Olga was still in a snit when she came back from the loading dock, and she did indeed want to disassemble the not-quite-complete jigsaw, but Dave was able to distract her by waving the cribbage board in her face. They played 3 games. Dave lost all 3 and was skunked in the last. Olga was not always sure who he was, and there were days when she believed she was back in Atlanta living in an aunt's boarding house, but when it came to cribbage, she never missed a double run or a 15-for-2. She's also really lucky, Dave thought, not without resentment. Who winds up with 20 points in the goddamn crib? Around 11:15, Fox News had given way to Drew Carey, flogging prizes on The Price is Right, Ollie Franklin returned and made his way to the cribbage board. A shave and a neat short-sleeved shirt made him look almost dapper.
"Hey, Olga, I have something for you, girlfriend."
"I am not your girlfriend," Olga said.
There was a small, meanly amused glint in her eye.
"If you ever had a girlfriend, I'll be dipped in bear shit."
In gratitude, thy name is woman,
Ollie said without rancor.
Hold out your hand.
And when she did, he dropped 4 newly constructed jigsaw pieces into it. She glared at them suspiciously.
What are these?
The missing pieces.
Missing pieces to what?
The puzzle you and Dave were doing. Remember the puzzle?
Dave could almost hear the clicking beneath her frizzy cloud of white hair as old relays and corroded memory banks came to life.
Of course I do, but this will never fit.
Try them, Ollie invited.
Dave took them from her before she could. To him, they looked perfect. One showed that lacework of girders. The 2 that had been close together showed part of a pink cloud of the horizon. The 4th showed the forehead and pertly cocked beret of a tiny boulevardier who could have been promenading on the Place Vendôme. It was pretty amazing, he thought. Ollie might be 85, but he still had game. Dave returned the pieces to Olga, who tapped them in, one after the other. Each fit perfectly.
Voila, Dave said, and shook Ollie's hand. Too fini! Wonderful!
Olga was bent so close to the puzzle that her nose was touching it. This new girder piece doesn't quite match up with the ones around it. Dave said, that's a little thankless, even for you, Olga. Olga made a humph sound. Over her head, Ollie waggled his eyebrows. Dave waggled back.
Sit with us at lunch.
I may skip lunch, Ollie said. I'll walk, and my latest artistic triumph have tired me out.
He bent to look at the puzzle and sighed.
No, they don't match. But close.
Close only counts in horseshoes, Olga said. Boyfriend.
Ollie made his slow way toward the door opening on the evergreen wing, cane tapping its unmistakable 1-2-3 rhythm. He didn't appear at lunch, and when he didn't show up for dinner, that day's duty nurse checked on him and found him lying on the coverlet of his bed, with his talented hands laced together on his chest. He seemed to have died as he lived, peacefully and with no fuss. That evening, Dave tried the door of his late friend's suite and found it open. He sat on the stripped bed with the silver pocket watch laid on his palm, the cover open so he could watch the second hand go round in the little circle above the 6. He looked at Ollie's possessions, the books on the shelf, the sketch pads on the desk, the various drawings taped to the walls, and wondered who would take them. The ne'er-do-well brother, he supposed. He fished for the name, and it came to him, Tom, and the niece was Martha. Over the bed was a charcoal drawing of a handsome young man with his hair combed high and spangles on his cheeks. On his cupid's bow lips was a smile. It was small, but inviting. 4. The summer came full, then began to ebb. School buses rolled down Maryland Avenue. Olga Glyukov's condition declined. She mistook Dave for her late husband more frequently. Her cribbage skills remained, but she began to lose her English. Although Dave's older son and daughter lived close by in the suburbs, it was Peter who came to visit most frequently, driving in from the farm in Hemingford County, 60 miles away, and often taking his father out to dinner. Halloween rolled around. The staff decorated the common room with orange and black streamers. The residents of Lakeview Assisted Living Center celebrated All Hallows with cider, pumpkin pie, and popcorn bowls for the few whose teeth were still up to the challenge. Many spent the evening in costume, which made Dave Calhoun think of something his old friend had said during their last conversation, about how, in the late 80s, going to the gay clubs had been too much like attending the masquerade and Poe's story about the Red Death. He supposed Lakeview was also a kind of club, and sometimes it was gay. But there was a drawback. You couldn't leave, unless you had relatives willing to take you in. Peter and his wife would have done that for Dave if he had asked, would have given him the room where their son Jerome had once lived. But Peter and Alicia were getting on themselves now, and he would not inflict himself on them. One warm day in early November, he went out onto the flagstone patio and sat on one of the benches there. The paths beyond were inviting in the sunshine, but he no longer dared the steps. He might fall going down, which would be bad. He might not be able to get back up again without help, which would be humiliating. He spied a young woman standing by the fountain. She wore the kind of shin-length, frilly-collar dress you only saw nowadays in old black-and-white movies on TCM. Her hair was bright red. She smiled at him and waved.
"Why, look at you," Dave thought. "Didn't I see you not long after World War II ended, getting out of your boyfriend's pickup truck at the Humble Oil Station in Omaha?"
As if hearing this thought, the pretty redhead tipped him a wink and then twitched up the hem of her dress slightly, showing her knees.
"Hello, Miss Yummy," Dave thought. And then, "Once you did a lot better than that."
The memory made him laugh. She laughed in return. This he saw, but could not hear, although she was close and his ears were still sharp. Then she walked behind the fountain and didn't come out. Yet Dave had reason to believe she would be back. He had glimpsed the life force down there, no more and no less, the strong beating heart of beauty and desire. Next time, she would be closer. 5. Peter came into town the following week, and they went out to dinner at a nice place close by. Dave ate well and drank 2 glasses of wine. They perked him up considerably. When the meal was done, he took Ollie's silver watch from his inner coat pocket, coiled the heavy chain around it, and pushed it across the tablecloth to his son.
"What's this?" Peter asked.
"It was a gift from a friend," Dave said. "He gave it to me shortly before he passed on. I want you to have it."
Peter attempted to push it back.
"I can't take this, Dad. It's too nice."
"Actually, you'd be doing me a favor. Because of the arthritis. It's very hard for me to wind it, and pretty soon I won't be able to at all. Darn thing's at least 120 years old, and a watch that's made it that far deserves to run as long as it can. So please, take it."
"Well, when you put it that way."
Peter took the watch and dropped it into his pocket.
"Thanks, Dad. It's a beaut."
At the next table, so close Dave could have reached out and touched her, sat the redhead. There was no meal in front of her, but no one seemed to notice. At this distance, Dave saw that she was more than pretty. She was downright beautiful. Surely more beautiful than that long-ago girl had been, sliding out of her boyfriend's pickup with her skirt momentarily bunched in her lap. But what of that? Such revisions were, like birth and death, the ordinary course of things. Memory's job was not only to recall the past, but to burnish it. The redhead slid her skirt up farther this time, revealing one long white thigh for a second, perhaps even two, and winked. Dave winked back. Peter turned to look and saw only an empty four-top table with a reserved sign on it. When he turned back to his father, his eyebrows were raised. Dave smiled.
"Just something in my eye. It's gone now. Why don't you get the check? I'm tired and ready to go back."
Thinking of Michael McDowell. There's a saying, if you can remember the 60s, you weren't there. Total bullshit, and here's a case in point. Tommy wasn't his name, and he wasn't the one who died, but otherwise this is how it went down, back when we all thought we were going to live forever and change the world.
Tommy, read by Stephen King.
Tommy died in 1969. He was a hippie with leukemia. Bummer, man. After the funeral came the reception at Newman Center. That's what his folks called it. The reception. My friend Phil said, "Isn't that what you have after a fucking wedding?" The freaks all went to the reception. Daryl wore his cape. There were sandwiches to eat and grape drink in Dixie cups. My friend Phil said, "What is this grape shit?" I said it was Xarex. I recognized it, I said, from MYF. "What's that shit?" asked Phil. "Methodist Youth Fellowship," I said. "I went for 10 years and once did a flannel board of Noah and the Ark." "Fuck your Ark," said Phil, "and fuck the animals who rode on it." Phil, a young man with strong opinions. After the reception, Tommy's parents went home. I imagine they cried and cried. The freaks went to 110 North Main. We cranked up the stereo. I found some Grateful Dead records. I hated the Dead. Of Jerry Garcia, I used to say, "I'll be grateful when he's dead." Turned out I wasn't. Oh, well, Tommy liked them. Also, dear God, Kenny Rogers. We smoked dope in Zigzag Papers. We smoked Winston's and Pall Malls. We drank beer and ate scrambled eggs. We rapped about Tommy. It was pretty nice. And when the Wild Stein Club showed up, all 8 of them, we let them in because Tommy was gay and sometimes wore Daryl's cape. We all agreed his folks had done him righteous. Tommy wrote down what he wanted, and they gave him most of it. He was dressed in his best as he lay in his new narrow apartment. He wore his bell-bottom blue jeans and his favorite tie-dye shirt. Melissa Big Girl Freak made that shirt. I don't know what happened to her. She was there one day, then gone down that lost highway. I associate her with melting snow. Main Street and Orono would gleam so wet and bright it hurt your eyes. That was the winter the Lemon Piper sang Green Tambourine. His hair was shampooed. It went to his shoulders. Man, it was clean. I bet the mortician washed it. He was wearing his headband with the peace sign stitched in white silk. "He looked like a dude," said Phil. "He was getting drunk." Phil was always getting drunk. Jerry Garcia was singing Truckin'. It's a pretty stupid song. "Fucking Tommy," said Phil. "Drink to the motherfucker." We drank to the motherfucker. "He wasn't wearing his special button," said Indian Scontris. Indian was in the Wild Stein Club. Back then he knew every dance. These days he sells insurance in Brewer. He told his mother he wanted to be buried wearing his button. "That is so bogus." I said, "His mom just moved it under his vest." I looked. It was a leather vest with silver buttons. Tommy bought it at the free fair. I was with him that day. There was a rainbow, and from a loudspeaker, Canned Heat sang, "Let's Work Together." "I'm here, and I'm queer," said the button his mother moved beneath his vest. "She should have left it alone," said Indian Scontris. "Tommy was proud. He was a very proud queer." Indian Scontris was crying. Now he sells whole life policies and has 3 daughters. Turned out not to be so gay after all, but selling insurance is very queer, in my opinion. "She was his mother," I said, "and kissed his scrapes when he was young." "What does that have to do with it?" asked Indian Scontris. "Fucking Tommy," said Phil, and raised his beer high. "Let's toast the motherfucker." We toasted the motherfucker. That was 40 years ago. Tonight I wonder how many hippies died in those few sunshine years. Must have been quite a few. It's just statistics, man. And I'm not just talking about the war. You had your car accidents, your drug overdoses, plus booze, bar fights, the occasional suicide, and let's not leave out leukemia. All the usual suspects is all I'm saying. How many were buried in their hippie duds? This question occurs to me in the whispers of the night. It must have been quite a few, although it was fleeting, the time of the freaks. Their free fair is now underground, where they still wear their bell-bottoms and headbands, and there is mold on the full sleeves of their psychedelic shirts. The hair in those narrow rooms is brittle, but still long. The man's barber has not touched it in 40 years. No gray has frosted it. What about the ones who went down clasping